Lecture 5, Kobowitz, Friday, June 13th, 1924. The purpose of the cow horn preparations I introduced yesterday is simply to improve and enhance your manuring. You will, of course, still need to go on manuring. Today we would like to consider how this manuring can be done in accordance with the perspective we developed yesterday, namely that the etheric vitality must be retained within the realm of the living, that it should never leave the realm of growth. That's why it is so important for us to recognize that the soil surrounding the growing plant's roots is a living entity with a vegetative life of its own, a kind of extension of plant growth into the earth. Yesterday, I even went so far as to show how we can imagine the transition between a raised up mound of soil, which possesses some internal vitality due to its humus content, and the bark that surrounds a tree and seals it off from the outside. In modern times, people have lost all insight into the great interrelationships of nature. Thus, it is not surprising that they have also lost all insight into how the life that is common to plants and to the soil also extends into the excretory products of life as we find them in manure. It was inevitable that insight into the forces of life would gradually disappear. Now, as I said in the discussion yesterday, spiritual science should not act out of a certain fanaticism as something turbulent and revolutionary with respect to the achievements of the modern world in the various fields of practical life. These achievements should be fully acknowledged. The only things that merit our active opposition are those that are so bound up with the modern materialistic worldview that they rest on totally false premises. We must acknowledge what is legitimate and simply complement it with what can flow from a living conception of the world. That is why I am not going to spend much time describing how manure, liquid manure, or compost should be prepared for use as fertilizer. A great deal has already been accomplished in this regard. Perhaps we will have time to say more on the subject during the discussion session this afternoon. Let me start by saying that the idea that we are exploiting the land when we farm is quite accurate. In fact, such exploitation is unavoidable because with everything we send off the farm and out into the world, we are taking away forces from the soil and even from the air, which need to be replenished. Eventually, the manure must be treated in order for it to acquire the capacity to properly vitalize the depleted soil. It is just here that various misconceptions have recently arisen as a result of materialistic ways of thinking. For example, scientists of today study in great detail the activity of bacteria, the smallest living things. They credit these microscopic organisms with being able to condition the manure in the right way, and this has led to extremely ingenious and logical attempts to inoculate the soil. In most cases, this has had no lasting positive effect, since the reasoning behind it is roughly equivalent to thinking that a room is dirty because there are a lot of flies in it. The room is not dirty because of the flies. The flies are there because the room is dirty. And you will never get the room any cleaner by dreaming up all kinds of ways of either getting rid of the flies or of increasing their numbers in the hope that they will eat up all the dirt. Not much can be achieved through methods like that. It is much more effective to tackle the dirt directly. Thus, when animal manures are used as fertilizer, the appearance of microorganisms must simply be regarded as something that results from the processes that are taking place within the manure. These creatures are useful as a symptom of the condition that the manure is in, but there is little to be gained by inoculating the manure with them or breeding them on purpose. If anything, it would be better to combat them. When we are dealing with the living realm, which is so important for agriculture, it is always a matter of keeping to larger perspectives. As much as possible, we must avoid regarding these tiny creatures in an atomistic manner. Of course, making a statement like this does no good at all unless you can also show how the things ought to be done. What I've just been talking about has also been stressed by other people, of course, but knowing what is right is not the only important thing. Something may be perfectly correct, but if this is something negative, it is often not possible to get anywhere unless positive principles can be put forward as well. As a general rule, when it is not possible to make positive suggestions, it is better to refrain from stressing the negative, since that only makes people angry. A second result of materialistic ways of thinking is the idea of treating the manure with all kinds of inorganic compounds and chemical elements. Once again, experience has shown that this has no lasting positive effect. We must understand that if we try to improve manure with inorganic chemicals, we will only succeed in penetrating and enlivening the watery part of the soil. In order to grow sound and substantial plants, however, this is not enough because no further vitalization proceeds from the water that seeps through the soil. We have to enliven the soil directly, and this cannot be done with mineral fertilizers, but only by means of organic material that has been conditioned to organize and enliven the solid earth itself. To indicate how this stimulus can be imparted to manure, or liquid manure, or any other sort of organic matter, is the task of spiritual science with respect to agriculture. Spiritual science always looks to the large-scale activities of life and ignores the microscopic realm and the conclusions drawn from that realm, because this is of less importance. The task of spiritual science is to observe the macrocosm, the broadest dimensions of the workings of nature, and to understand these workings. Now, in the current agricultural literature, you will find various statements derived from what people believe to be their experience, to the effect that nitrogen, phosphoric acid, lime, potash, chlorine, and even iron are all important to have in the soil if plants are to thrive. On the other hand, silicic acid, lead, arsenic, mercury, they even include sodium compounds in this category, are said to be of value to plants only as stimulants. Such statements go to show that people are groping in the dark. It is only fortunate, thanks to old traditions, no doubt, that people do not do the crazy things to plants that they would if they seriously followed such statements. As a matter of fact, it is impossible to follow them. What then is the real state of affairs? If we fail to take proper account of silicic acid, lead, mercury, or arsenic, nature does not leave us as forsaken as it does if we fail to properly consider potash or lime or phosphoric acid. This is because silicic acid, lead, mercury, and arsenic are provided by the heavens, provided freely, along with the rain. On the other hand, for phosphoric acid, potash, and lime to be present in the soil in the right way, we must properly manure the soil, since these things are not a free gift from heaven. Even so, over many years of farming, it is possible to deplete the soil. Indeed, we deplete it constantly. That is why we have to apply manure. But eventually, as is already the case on many farms, what we can replace through manuring is no longer sufficient. Then we begin to exploit the land. Then it becomes permanently impoverished. We must ensure that the real natural process can take place in the right way. What are called stimulant effects are actually the most important effects of all. It is just the substances that are regarded as unnecessarily, that are actively present in fine dosages all around the earth, and plants need them just as much as they need what comes to them from the earth. These substances are absorbed by the plants from the surrounding universe. Mercury, arsenic, silicic acid. The plants absorb them out of the soil after the substances themselves have been radiated into it. We human beings, however, are quite capable of preventing the soil from properly receiving what the plants need from the surrounding universe. If we continue to fertilize haphazardly, we may gradually prevent the soil from absorbing what is active in finest homeopathic doses as silicic acid, lead, and mercury. What comes in from the periphery in this way is needed by the plants to help them build up their body in the form of carbon. For this reason, we cannot stop with what I mentioned yesterday. The manure we have must also receive further treatment. It is not a question of merely augmenting the manure with substances that we believe will be of benefit to the plants. It is a question of infusing the manure with living forces, which are much more important to the plants than the material forces, the mere substances. Although we might gradually make our soil especially rich in one substance or another, that would not help the plants unless our manuring also enabled them to absorb what the soil offered. That is the important thing. People today are totally unaware of the potent effect that tiny quantities can have on living things. However, Frau Dr. Kalisko's brilliant investigations into the effects of smallest entities have now placed what was blind groping in homeopathy onto a sound scientific basis. I believe that this has made it scientifically acceptable to say that just those radiant forces needed by the organic world are released when small quantities of substance are applied in the appropriate way. When it comes to manuring, it won't be difficult at all for us to use small quantities in the right way. We have already seen how to make the cow horn preparations and how to apply them either before or after manuring. They supply forces that enhance the effectiveness of the manure that is used normally. But we must also experiment with other ways of giving the manure the right degree of vitality and the right consistency. We must enable it to retain of its own accord the proper amount of nitrogen and other substances that it needs in order to bring vitality to the soil. Today, I would like to indicate some general guidelines for working in this way, for working with things that can be added to the manure in small doses, in addition to what we take out of the cow horn, so that the manure can become vitalized and can transmit this vitality to the soil where the plants will grow. I'm going to mention specific things, but let me emphasize right from the beginning that if one or the other of them is difficult to find in a given area, it is possible to replace it with certain other things. There is only one case in which substitution will not be possible, because what is so characteristic in this particular plant is not likely to be found in the same way in any other species. To begin with, we need to make sure that the major elements of the organic realm, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, and sulfur, can come together in the right way with other substances, with potash salts, for example. It is generally known that plants require a certain amount of potash salts for growth, and that potash salts, or potash in general, tends to restrict the growth process to those parts of the plant that usually become the solid framework, that is, to the stems and stem-like parts. But in the context of the interaction between the plant and the soil, it is important to transform this potash so that it relates itself properly to the forming of the proteinaceous material. The proteinaceous material that constitutes the actual body of the plant. This can be achieved by doing the following. Take some yarrow, a plant that is usually easy to obtain. If it does not happen to grow in your area, you can use the dried herb just as well. This yarrow is actually a miracle of creation. So is any other plant, of course, but if you compare yarrow to any other plant, you will be deeply touched by the particular wonder of yarrow. I told you how the spirit uses sulfur to moisten its fingers when it wants to carry substances, carbon, nitrogen, and so on, to their proper organic destinations. Well, the way yarrow appears in nature, it is as if some plant designer had used an ideal model in bringing sulfur into relationship with the other plant substances. You might say that in yarrow, as in no other plant, the nature spirits reach the height of perfection in their use of sulfur. And if yarrow is brought into the realm of biological activity in the right way, its effect within the animal or human organism is to correct any weakness of the astral body. If we know this, we can trace the essence of yarrow still further throughout the process of plant growth in nature. Yarrow is already a great asset when it grows wild in the country, along paths or at the edge of fields, where grain, potato, or other crops are being grown. Of course, it should not be allowed to become a nuisance, but it is never actually harmful, so under no circumstances should you try to eradicate it. Like some sympathetic people in human society who exert an influence just by their presence and not by what they say, yarrow's mere presence in areas where it grows abundantly is extremely beneficial. Now, here is what you can do. Take the same part of the yarrow that is also used medicinally, the umbel-like inflorescences. If possible, it's best to pick the fresh inflorescences and then let them dry just a bit. You don't have to let them dry very much. If you cannot get the fresh yarrow, but only the dried herb, you should first try to moisten the inflorescences a little with some juice squeezed from the leaves. Even with dried leaves, you can get the juice you need if you make a decoction. And now you will see how we always stay within the living realm. After taking a handful or two of yarrow and compressing it somewhat, take the bladder of a deer and enclose the yarrow substance in this. as best you can, and then tie the whole thing shut. You now have a fairly compact mass of yarrow inside the bladder. Hang it up in the sunniest spot you can find and let it stay there during the summer. When autumn comes, then take it down and put it in the ground, not too deeply, and let it spend the winter there. You thus have yarrow flowers, which can also have gone to seed a bit, enclosed for a year within the bladder of a deer and exposed to whatever may influence them, partly above ground and partly below ground. You will find that they take on a very characteristic consistency during the course of the winter. Once they are in this form, you can keep this material for as long as you want. Then take this material from inside the bladder and add it to a manure pile, which can even be as big as a house. You don't have to put a lot of effort into this. The radiation will work even if you only mix it in a little bit. The radiant energy in it is so strong that it will influence the entire quantity of manure, or also liquid manure or compost, no matter how much it is divided up. Materialists will believe us here, since they themselves talk about radium. The effect of this material derived from yarrow is so enlivening and refreshing that simply by using this treated manure in the ordinary way, a lot will be done to counteract the unavoidable exploitation of the land that comes about through raising crops. In this way, the manure, once again, becomes able to enliven the soil so that it can absorb and retain the extremely fine doses of silicic acid and lead and so on that come toward the earth. Again, this is something for the members of the agricultural circle to experiment with. They will see that it really does work. Now, since it is always preferable to work out of insight, there is the following question. We've gotten to know the yarrow plant. It is able to radiate its effects through large masses of manure because its own highly dilute sulfur content is combined with potassium in such an ideal way. But why must we put the yarrow specifically into the bladder of a deer? Here we need to have insight into the entire process related to this bladder. A deer is a creature that is intimately related not so much to the earth as to the earth's surroundings, to the cosmic aspect of the earth's surroundings. That is why deer have antlers, which have the function I explained to you yesterday. What is present in yarrow is especially strongly preserved in the bodies of humans and animals by means of the process that takes place between the kidneys and the bladder. And this process is dependent on the material constitution of the bladder. As thin as it may be in terms of substance, in terms of its forces, a deer bladder is almost a replica of the cosmos. A deer is involved with forces that are quite different from those of a cow, which are all related to the interior. By putting the yarrow into a deer bladder, we significantly enhance its inherent ability to combine sulfur with other substances. Handling yarrow in the way I have indicated is thus a fundamental means for improving manure, and one that always stays within the living realm. It's important to note that we never get into inorganic chemistry. Everything stays within the realm of the living. Let's take another example. If we want to give our manure the possibility of absorbing vitality that it then can impart to the soil where the plants are growing, we must make the manure especially able to combine the elements that are necessary for plant growth. In addition to potash, these include calcium, various compounds of calcium. In the case of yarrow, we were dealing primarily with the effects of potash. If we want to draw in the effects of calcium as well, we need another plant. This plant may not arouse our enthusiasm as readily as yarrow, but it too contains homeopathic sulfur, which enables it to attract the other substances it needs and incorporate them into an organic process. This plant is chamomile, Chamomilla officinalis. We may not simply say that chamomile is characterized by a high content of potash and calcium. Rather, the situation is as follows. Yarrow develops its sulfur forces primarily in the potash forming process. It therefore contains sulfur in exactly the amount needed for working on potash. Chamomile, on the other hand, works on calcium in addition to potash, and thereby develops what can help to ward off the harmful effects of fructification and keep the plant healthy. So the marvelous thing is that, like yarrow, chamomile contains some sulfur, but in a way, in a different quantity, because it has to work on calcium too. Now, we must go further. You will find that the results of spiritual research are always derived from the greater whole, from macrocosmic rather than microcosmic relations. We shall see this if we now trace the process that chamomile undergoes after having been ingested by a human being or animal. Here, the bladder is of no particular significance. What is of great significance is the substance of the walls of the intestines. So if we want to work with chamomile as we did with yarrow, we must pick its beautiful, delicate white and yellow flower heads and treat them just like we did the yarrow umbels, but we must stuff them into cattle intestines rather than in a bladder. Once again, this is a lovely thing to do and does not require much. Instead of using the intestines for sausage casings, which is what is usually done with them, we simply make a different kind of sausage by filling them with chamomile flowers. Notice how in this instance too, we stay within the realm of the living. After that, all that remains to be done is to expose this material to the natural influences in the right way. In this case, since we want it to be worked on by a vitality that is as closely related to the earthly element as possible, we need to take these precious little sausages, and they really are precious, and again, let them spend the entire winter underground. They should be placed not too deeply in soil that is as rich as possible in humus. We should also try to choose a spot that will remain covered with snow for a long time, and where this snow will be shone upon by the sun as much as possible, so that the cosmic astral influences will work down into the soil where the sausages are buried. Then when spring comes, dig up the sausages and store them or add their contents to your manure, just as you did with the yarrow. You will find that your manure not only has more stable nitrogen content than other manures, but that it also has the ability to enliven the soil so that plant growth is extraordinarily stimulated. Above all, you will get healthier plants, really much healthier plants, if you fertilize in this way. To our modern way of thinking, this all sounds quite insane. I am well aware of that. But just think of how many things were originally rejected as crazy, yet after a few years became accomplished fact. I wish you could have read the Swiss newspapers when somebody first thought of laying train tracks up the mountains. You would not believe how they ridiculed that poor person. But a short time later, the mountain railways were there, and now it no longer occurs to anyone that whoever first thought of building them was crazy. It is just a question of overcoming people's prejudices. As I said before, if these two particular plants are difficult to get, you could substitute something else, although it's really better not to, and the dried herbs work just as well. On the other hand, there is one plant whose beneficial influence on the manure is such that it would be next to impossible to find a substitute for it. We are often not very fond of this plant, at least not in the sense of wanting to fondle it, because the plant in question is stinging nettle. But stinging nettle is, in fact, the greatest benefactor of plant growth, and it can hardly be replaced by any other plant. If it is not available locally, you really must get the dried herb from somewhere else. Stinging nettle is a real jack of all trades. It can do many different things. It, too, contains sulfur, which, as I have already explained, plays an important role in assimilating and incorporating the spiritual. Stinging nettle also carries the radiations and currents of potash and calcium, but in addition, it has a kind of iron radiation that is nearly as beneficial for the whole course of nature as the iron radiations in our blood are for us. Because it is such a good influence, the stinging nettle we find growing wild really does not deserve our customary scorn. It should actually be growing all around our hearts, since the role it plays in nature, by virtue of its marvelous inner structure and way of working, is very similar to that of the heart in the human organism. Stinging nettle is indeed a great boon. If it should ever become necessary to reduce a soil's iron content, please excuse me, Count Kaiserlink, if I become too local with my example. Planting nettles in out-of-the-way spots can do a great deal towards freeing the upper layer of the soil from the influence of iron. Nettles like iron so much that they draw it out of the soil and into themselves. And although this does not get rid of the iron as such, it at least undermines its effect on the growth of other plants. Planting stinging nettles around here, therefore, would be of particular importance. I only wanted to mention this in passing to make you aware that the mere presence of stinging nettle can already be of significance for the plant growth in its surroundings. Now, to improve your manure still more, take whatever stinging nettles you can gather, and once again, let them wilt slightly. This compresses them a bit, and put them straight into the ground without any bladder or intestines, though you can use a thin layer of loose peat or something similar to separate them from the surrounding soil. Bury them right in the ground, but mark the place carefully so you do not just dig out plain soil when you come back for them. Let the nettles spend the winter and also the following summer in the ground. They need to be buried for a whole year. Then you will have a substantiality that is extremely effective. When you add this to your manure, just like the other preparations, the effect will be to make the manure inwardly sensitive and receptive so that it acts as if it were intelligent and does not allow decomposition to take place in the wrong way or let nitrogen escape or anything like that. This addition not only makes the manure intelligent, it also makes the soil more intelligent so that it individualizes itself and conforms to the particular plants that you grow in it. Adding urtica dioica in this form is really like an infusion of intelligence for the soil. You see, modern methods of improving manure may sometimes give astonishing outward results, but ultimately they tend to turn all the first-rate agricultural products into mere stomach fillers. They will no longer have real nutritive power for human beings. It is important not to be deceived by things that look big and swollen. What is important is that their appearance be consistent with real nutritive power. Now, it can happen that plant diseases may appear on our farms. I want to speak about them right now in rather general terms. People today like to specialize, so they talk about specific diseases. In the pursuit of science, that's all well and good, because you do need to know what each disease looks like. But in the end, it is much the same as with a doctor. Being able to describe an illness is usually not very useful. It's much more important to be able to cure it. Bringing about healing requires us to work from totally different points of view than we do when we are describing diseases. We can achieve the greatest degree of precision in describing illnesses and know exactly what is going on in the diseased organism, according to the principles of modern physiology or physiological chemistry, and yet still not be able to cure anything. You cannot heal according to histological or microscopic findings. In order to heal, you must understand the broad interrelationships. That is how it is in the plant world, too. And since plants are simpler than humans or animals, healing can take place on a more general level. With plants, you can use a kind of universal remedy. If this weren't the case, we would be in a difficult position, much as we often already are when we treat animals, which is something we still need to speak about. We are not in this position with human beings because people can tell us what is hurting them, whereas animals and plants cannot. But with them, healing is a more general process. Now, not all, but a large number of plant diseases can be alleviated just by means of a rational method of manuring. What is needed is that the manuring add calcium to the soil. For the calcium to have a healing effect, however, it has to be calcium from something living. We cannot evade the organic realm. It won't help at all to add ordinary lime or any other calcium compound that has fallen out of the organic realm. Now, one plant that contains plenty of calcium is the oak. 77% of its substance consists of finely distributed calcium. And oak bark, in particular, represents a kind of intermediate product between the plant and the living earth element. In the same sense as I already described the kinship between bark and living earth. Of the many forms in which calcium can appear, the calcium structure of oak bark is the most ideal. Calcium has the effect that I have already described. It creates order where the etheric body is working too strongly so that the astrality cannot influence whatever organic entity is involved. Calcium in any form will kill off or dampen the etheric body and thereby free up the influence of the astral body. But when we want a rampant etheric development to contract in a beautiful and regular manner without any shocks, then we need to use calcium in the particular form in which it is found in oak bark. For this purpose, we collect the oak bark that can be easily obtained. We do not need a great deal. Then we chop it up until it is of crumb-like consistency, put it into a skull of any one of our domestic animals, it hardly matters which one, and finally, close up the skull, preferably with a piece of bone. Next, we place the skull in a relatively shallow hole in the ground, cover it with loose peat, and set up some kind of a pipe or gutter so that as much rainwater as possible flows into the hole. You might even put the skull into a rain barrel where water can constantly flow in and out, then add some kind of plant matter that will decay so that the oak bark in its bony container lies in this organic muck for the whole winter, or better still, for the whole autumn and winter. Water from melting snow will do just as well as rainwater. When this material is added to your manure pile, it will truly provide the forces to prevent or arrest harmful plant diseases. We have now added four different things. All this takes a certain amount of work, of course, but if you stop and think about it, it actually takes less work than all the fooling around in chemical laboratories that goes on in the name of agriculture, and which also has to be paid for somehow. You will find that what we have discussed here is much more economical. Now, we still need something else, something that will draw in the silicic acid from the whole cosmic surroundings. We need this silicic acid in the plants, but it's precisely with regard to the absorption of silicic acid that the soil is losing its strength over time. It is happening very gradually, so we don't notice it. People who look only at microscopic things, not at the macrocosm, are not concerned about this loss of silicic acid because they do not think it is significant for plant growth. But in point of fact, it is of utmost importance to plant growth. In this regard, there is something we need to know. What we're talking about is now less likely to be regarded by educated people as a sign of utter derangement than it would have been not too long ago. Today, the transmutation of elements is spoken about quite openly. Observation of many elements has tamed the lions of materialism in this instance. Still, certain things that are going on around us all the time are completely unknown. If they were known, it would be easier for people to believe such things as I have just been speaking about. I am perfectly aware that people who are caught up in current ways of thinking will object that I have not said anything about how to improve the nitrogen content of manure. But in fact, I have been talking about this all the time, namely when I spoke about yarrow, chamomile, and nettle. Because in organic processes, there is a hidden alchemy at work. In this hidden alchemy, potash, for instance, if it is properly functioning in the organic processes, can really be transformed into nitrogen. And even lime, if it is properly functioning, can also be transformed into nitrogen. As you know, all four of the elements that I discussed are involved in plant growth. Thus, in addition to sulfur, there is also hydrogen. I have already told you about the significance of hydrogen. Now, there exists between lime and hydrogen a mutual qualitative relationship that is similar to the qualitative relationship that exists between oxygen and nitrogen in the air. Even a purely outward procedure, like quantitative chemical analysis, could reveal that there is a relationship between the association of oxygen and nitrogen in the air, and the association of lime and hydrogen in organic processes. Under the influence of hydrogen, lime and potash are constantly being transmuted, first into something resembling nitrogen, and then into nitrogen itself. The nitrogen that comes about in this way is extremely useful for plant growth, but we must allow it to be produced by means of the methods I have described. Silicic acid, as you know, contains silicon. In a living organism, silicon, too, is transformed into an extremely important substance, one that is not currently included among the chemical elements. Silicic acid is needed to draw in the cosmic factor, and a thorough interaction must come about between the silicic acid in the plant and the potassium, not the calcium. We have to enliven the soil through manuring so that it can facilitate this interaction. We need to look for a plant whose own potassium silicic acid relationship will enable it to impart this power to the manure. When again it is added to the manure in a kind of homeopathic dosage. We can readily find this a plant. It is Taraxacum, the dandelion. Here again, just to have it growing on our farm is already beneficial. The innocent yellow dandelion is a tremendous asset because it mediates between the fine homeopathic distribution of salicylic acid in the cosmos and the salicylic acid that is actually used over the whole region. The dandelion is really a kind of messenger from heaven. But if we need this plant and want to make it effective in the manure, we have to utilize it in the right way. It must be exposed, of course, to the earth's influence, to the earth's winter influence. But in order to acquire the surrounding forces, we must also treat it just as we have the others. Collect the yellow heads of the dandelion and let them wilt a little. Then pack them together and sew them up in a bovine mesentery and put them too in the earth through the winter. When these balls are dug up in the spring, they will in fact be thoroughly saturated with cosmic influence and can be stored until needed. This material can be added to the manure in the same way as before, and it will give the soil the ability to attract just as much salicylic acid from the atmosphere and from the cosmos as is needed by the plants. In this way, the plants will become sensitive to everything at work in their environment and then be able to draw in whatever else they need themselves. Even plants, in order to grow properly, need to have a certain ability to sense and perceive. In the same way that I can pass by a dull and insensitive person without being noticed, so can everything within and above the soil pass by a dull and insensitive plant. What it does not perceive, it cannot put to use for its own growth. But if a plant is very delicately permeated and enlivened by salicylic acid, it becomes sensitive to everything and can attract what it needs. However, it is very easy to weaken plants so they can only take advantage of what is present in their immediate environment, which is not good, of course. But if you treat the soil as I have described, the plants will be able to draw in what they need from a very wide area. They will then be able to use not only what is in their own field, but also what is in the soil of a nearby meadow, if they happen to need it. A plant can take advantage of what is in the soil of a neighboring forest if it has been inwardly sensitized in this manner. Such an interplay can be brought about by giving the plants the forces that the dandelion makes available to them. And so it seems to me that you should try to produce fertilizer by enriching the manure with these five ingredients or appropriate substitutes in the way I have suggested. Fertilizers of the future should not be prepared with all kinds of chemicals, but rather with yarrow, chamomile, nettle, oak bark, and dandelion. A fertilizer of this kind will in fact contain very much of what is actually needed. And if you can still bring yourself to do one more thing, before using this treated manure, press the blossoms from the valerian plant, Valeriana officinalis, and greatly dilute the extract with warm water. The extraction can be done at any time and can then be stored. If this diluted valerian juice is applied to the manure in a very fine manner, it will stimulate the manure to relate in the right way to the substance we called phosphorus. By using these six ingredients, you will be able to produce an excellent fertilizer from liquid manure as well as from solid manure or compost.
Thank you.